It is our goal with the Bibliophile podcast to identify best practitioners, past and present, whose roles are connected with the book in some way. And today we're looking at the great Alvin Lustig with the great Stephen Heller, who is a peerless documentarian of the graphic arts field. Welcome, Steve, once again to the Bibliophile.
Thanks for having me. I wouldn't call myself peerless, though. There are peers.
I think you are peerless, really. I mean, certainly in terms of the depth and breadth of your examination of this field.
Well, there are a lot of good people who are out there, scholars and collectors and aficionados.
Like
well, I'm very high on Rick Pointer in London, Roger Remington, who ran the RIT Design Archive, and our own archive here has Beth Kleber, and Cooper has Sasha Tuklowski. I can't pronounce his name.
You want to try it again?
No, it's not going to come. But
I always have trouble with Lisitsky.
Yeah, Lisitsky I got.
Okay.
It's the multi-syllable words.
Right. The Slavic syllables.
Yeah.
Okay. Alvin Lustig was born in 1915. Maybe you could take it from there.
Well, he was born into a family whose father, the patriarch of the family, and worked in the movie industry. And they moved from their home, original home, to Hollywood, where his father got involved with the Hollywood system. Alvin had a sister. He was a precocious child insofar as he was very smart. He wanted to be and learned how to be a magician at a very young age, did magic shows for the town and the school and the like. And he was very close to leaving school and becoming a magician. That didn't happen. His professional life began pretty early.
Steve, I just want to make a comment about this magician business. It seems to me that, you know, one of their key tricks or methods is sleight of hand and distracting you, sort of distracting your attention away from something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that fits directly with being a graphic designer, or I think he wanted to be thought of as a total designer. But you have a comment on that?
Well, I think design is kind of a sleight of hand. It's certainly something that to do well, you need to master a craft. You know, it's kind of stretching it to say it's magic, but some designers, as some artists, create a kind of magic on their canvas or drawing board. They create illusions. There is very little that's tactile in graphic design. The tactility comes in the paper that's used or the printing inks that are used and other kind of tricks and conceits that are used. But I would say that there may be a connection. I'm not finding it either.
Well, I'm just definitely there. I'm just not smart enough to really put it into words, I don't think.
Well, I'll join your club.
Okay, so sorry, I interrupted. Where did he go from being an amateur magician?
Well, he would do graphics for his school, and then he segued into creating graphics using metal type. He worked for Ward Ritchie Press, which was a big private press in Los Angeles at the time. His work developed from there. He basically wanted to be, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of things in design. He wanted to be an architect. So he studied with Frank Lloyd Wright for a very short period of time. and went to Taliesin East or West, one of the two. He found that working with Frank Lloyd Wright was not the utopia that he thought it might be.
I think a lot of people found that. Probably when you've got like a towering ego is kind of it's difficult to overcome at times.
Yeah, Superman can leap tall buildings in a single bound, but super egos go way into the heavens. And so at one point, almost as though he were an indentured servant, he decided to escape. And he left Taliesin and sent Wright a letter afterwards, which Wright responded to. But a lot of the early work that Lustig was doing with hot metal type configurations could be related to, on one hand, constructivism, using type materials from the type case to create imagery or decoration. And on another hand, it could be seen as a direct influence of Frank Lloyd Wright, who, when he did his graphics, kind of two-dimensionalized the three-dimensionality of his work. If you look at Frank Lloyd Wright's, even his private homes, there is a certain level of constructivism in there.
Okay, what does that mean?
It means that there are rectilinear shapes or curvilinear shapes that are placed together in a kind of, I guess I would equate it to children's play blocks.
Yeah, that's exactly like that famous house of his near Pittsburgh that I went to. And because he has such a gigantic ego, the ceilings were really low because he was so short. He didn't seem to care that anyone else might be taller than him.
Yeah, he also didn't seem to care that the materials would degrade over time. But I think that's common to many builders. They're not aware, although they should be. I mean, that should be part of their training, to know that certain materials will need to be renovated or restored, which is doubtless why you see so much scaffolding in New York, where every 5 or 6 years they have to fill in the points with concrete or some other sealant. Lustig.
Oh, Falling Waters, I think.
Falling Waters is the one you're talking about. Lustig did do architecture. He designed the Beverly Hills Hotel. He designed storefronts. He designed office spaces, structures, three-dimensional structures. He also was industrial in his interests. He designed the Rotoron helicopter, a two-seater helicopter that I would never go up in a million years, but it apparently worked. He designed furniture. He did all this without the degrees that would make him a legitimate practitioner. So he worked with people who could execute his designs, but remained in control of those designs. Graphic design was a profession that you didn't need to have a license for. And in fact, you know, you really didn't need much schooling. You needed training, you needed apprenticeship. But to be a graphic designer and then to teach what you know, you didn't need any of the degrees that we're so covetous of now and pay so much money to get now. And that I'm involved in now on an administrative level.
That sounds like fun.
It's fun and it's worthwhile because people are inspired by the people that they learn from. And Lustig was indeed a teacher, and people were indeed inspired by him. He was known mostly for his graphic design work, which fit into the modern sensibility and the modern, he used a modern language of design, collage, montage, drawing in a loose, abstract manner. He was influenced by many of the abstract expressionists, including Mark Rothko. So his work wasn't necessarily representational. He collaborated with photographers at times. You have the Lorca Three Stories book that you just bought, and that is one of the for me, one of the key books of the late 20th and early 21st century, because it breaks the image into a grid and then uses various elements, visual elements, mostly photographic elements, to tell a story on the cover. So the word Lorca, the name Lorca, is sketched in script out of sand. There's a piece of crumpled paper in the corner that says three stories on it. There's a photograph of a crucifix in three dimensions. There are other elements, and these are part of a montage ethic and aesthetic that is used a lot today. So much today that you'd have to call it the style of the day, even though it was the style of the 1930s and 40s and 50s.
So why are you so hyped on this particular dust jacket? Again, you've told me about, you've described it, but what gets you so excited about it?
Well, that it was out of the realm of conventional jackets. Same with jackets Paul Rand did, same with jackets that Leo Leoni did or Lester Beal did.
Spelt the wrong way, incidentally.
Excuse me?
Beal is spelt with two L's instead of an E, so.
Right. His way is the modernist way.
Okay.
The E doesn't...
I'm the traditional one. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the E doesn't necessarily work well with the L. So two L's.
Yeah, but my first name and my second name both have five letters in them. So
that's true. And your first name ends with an E, so that there's a...
No, it doesn't. There's an L.
Oh, okay.
But still.
Well, then I'll stick to my point.
Okay. And stop thinking about me.
Yeah. So what's special about that cover is that it's not a commercial solution.
Yeah.
It requires reading. It requires interpretation. It's not giving you something. It's telling you to figure it out for yourself. Follow the storyboard, as it were, and you'll end up with the title and author of the book. Whereas more narrative covers will give you a little vignette of the book, or at least a vignette of the sensibility of the book. But book jackets run a really wide gamut, from just telling you the title in a certain typeface. Sometimes the typefaces are arbitrary and sometimes they're very deliberate, to symbolic covers, which Lustig was known for, that really force the viewer to either think about what they mean or think about how they look together. You know, sometimes you buy from it, like New Directions books that he did were all, or for the most part, all sketches, line work that were very abstract, and you could only appreciate them when you see them all together, face out.
That involved the bookseller participating, and of course they tended not to put them all together, right?
No, they tended to put them spine out.
Yeah.
But, you know, the book buyer would pull them off the shelf and look at them, just as we do today, to see if we can find some of them, because they're so collectible.
Yeah. And they also, as you've said, they basically leave space for the viewer to participate and to figure out not the puzzle, but just figure things out. It's sort of a really strong invitation to do that.
Yeah.
Like, for example, with the Lorca name in the sand there, you look at the image of the surf above it, and I couldn't help but think, oh, that's just about to wipe out that writing.
And it's possible that that's what Lustig was thinking. It's possible that it happened purely by accident. But he wasn't known for his accidents. At age 40, he went blind.
Yeah, and died at 41, actually, right?
Yeah, he actually died or went blind earlier from infantile diabetes, for which there was no cure. And it took away his sight, but he was still healthy enough to work in the studio, and enlisted his studio assistants, which included his wife, Elaine Lustig-Cohen, who herself became a rather accomplished graphic designer and ultimately painter and collagist in her own right. And she passed away a couple of years ago. She was much younger than Alvin. She met Alvin as a teacher. And as many people do, love stems from deep respect and that kind of magic that happens worshiping a master.
I think that has certainly something to do with the fact that we admire Alvin. The material that he produced was original, and for some reason we bow down in front of originality and worship it. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, we can't do it. Second of all, there seems to be a divine presence for anything that's original. Where the hell does it come from? Who is the messenger? And why is the message being transmitted? You know, you could get into all sorts of religious hokum to explain it. But, and in fact, there is a rumor, whether it's true or not, I really don't know, that at a certain point, Alvin thought of himself as a Christ-like figure. Of course, these kinds of stories are easy to make up and propagate. Yeah. But he was a teacher, as I said, and he was a master of many forms. And he did believe quite fervently that design had curative powers. So read into it what you will.
Right. Tell me, if you will, about Jacob Zeitlin.
If I wrote about it, I don't remember.
He was a bookseller that seems to me he was pretty pivotal in Alvin's life, because he put him in touch with Ward Ritchie and also, I think, with James Laughlin, the young publisher of the New Directions.
Yeah, I don't remember the name. As I have mentioned, my memory is going the way of many people who are entering their twilight. But Ward Ritchie was very influential in Alvin's life. He gave Alvin space to work out of. Laughlin was key in the kinds of work that Alvin was allowed to do, you know, or enabled to do. He was an enabler, and he was a great small publisher in that tradition of publishers who worked outside of the system. And that, I think, is another area that we tend to worship. We worship the independents, the auteurs, the people who don't have to follow the rules and regs that are set down by successful companies, because if they don't follow them, the successful companies won't be successful any longer. So Laughlin saw a few things. He saw good modern writing and felt that in poetry and drama and novels, this should be brought to the public's attention and that there was a public waiting for it. He saw that creative activity extended beyond the word and onto the cover of the book or the jacket of the book, and, you know, made an entire package.
Yeah, this was the new classics. And I think he was so thrilled because Alvin's work sales went up, you say, 300%. So he was getting this important writing in front of way more people
at a reasonable price.
Yeah.
Even though books were not expensive then. New Directions, which I think still exists.
It does.
Was really a new direction. It's interesting when you're our ages, at least I remember seeing things with the word new in front of it and feeling a certain tingle. You know, like the new school in New York. What was so new about it? It was a school. What did it mean? What does that new mean? and new directions. Direction is a, you know, both a verb and a noun. And what does it mean to be new and going in a particular direction or directing? So there's something very visceral about the name of the company and how he chose to visually represent the company. And Lustig was doing work that was visually progressive.
I had a great conversation with the biographer, James Lachlan, Ian McNiven, a couple of years ago, which listeners can scurry over to if they wish to, on the site, thebibliophile.ca. Let's look at the fact that Alvin was fluent in the language of surrealistic iconography and symbolic abstraction.
Well, you know, there are elements of modern art that find their way into commercial art. There was a very significant catalyst in the 1920s named Ernest Elmo Calkins. He was an ad man. He was a minister's son from the Midwest. You look at a photograph of him and you think, this guy's an old guy. Right. But he had the common sense to see that in order to sell products, you had to be with the times, not rubbing up against the times. And he felt that after having seen the great exhibition in 1925 in Paris, the Exposition Industrielle, Arts et Industrielle, that America was behind in terms of how it was presenting its products. It was the biggest producer in the world, but it didn't sell in the most progressive manner. And it didn't sell in a way that would resell products to a customer. So he felt that it was imperative that product design and mostly product packaging and advertising design have some element of modern art in it to suggest to the viewer that they were getting in on the action, that they were not just buying a package of Quaker oats that had a Quaker on it. They were getting something that was new and improved. So he created something called Engineering the Goods. The
same as,
no, it's a concept which is similar to forced obsolescence, which is what Harley Earl created in Detroit for General Motors. Forced obsolescence meant that you devised a new style for something every year.
Yeah, that's what fashion is.
That's what fashion is all about. But fashion began not as a commercial asset, but as a kind of vanity tool. Go back to the 17th, 18th, 19th century. There wasn't a lot of mass marketing. There were customized tailoring. And there were styles that developed to suggest class or station on one hand. And on the other hand, you know, as the middle class was beginning to evolve, you needed something that symbolized that middle class. And it ultimately evolved into architecture and furniture and all sorts of things that people would buy as consumables that said, we're who we are, we're middle class.
Yeah, I read something fascinating, very tangentially related to this, that Hitler's mustache was not symbolic, but that was the style that sort of lower class laboring folk wore.
Yeah, he didn't invent the style.
No, he didn't. But he sure seems to have taken it over.
He took it over, but you know, it's like the Beatles' haircut wasn't original to the Beatles. Remember the Three Stooges? Mo had his own haircut.
Yeah. And who the hell wants to wear their hair like the Three Stooges?
Right. Or for that matter, Buster Brown. I mean, there were scores of rock and rollers who looked like Buster Brown.
Well, let's get back to Alvin. You define his style as expressionistic modernism. What on earth is that?
Well, he was a modernist insofar as he worked with the language that was coming out of Europe at the time that he found in magazines, Grafis, Gebras Graphique. He was expressionist because many of the things he did, particularly in book jackets, had a kind of visceral quality to them. They were not representational in the strict sense. They were emotional. So I use expressionist there as a kind of catch-all word.
Well, modernism itself is pretty catch-all too, isn't it? In the sense that there's a whole bunch of different movements that are wrapped up in.
Yeah, it's a slippery word.
Yeah. I mean,
if you take it at its face value, it just means something new.
So how come you use these slippery words then?
Because they've become part of the vocabulary. You know, while I hate jargon as a matter of policy, I feel that sometimes abbreviation, particularly for an audience that knows what the abbreviation means,
yes,
makes it easier to express, or at least easier for me to express. I'm sure that there are others who can say the same thing either in less jargonistic terms or less flourishy terms or more direct terminology. I have a manuscript out now where the copy editor sent back her notes and said, you're using expression too many times. So clearly I use it as a substitute for coming up with a different, maybe better definition.
I see, okay. Okay, please explain in simple language what you meant by he was a modernist rooted in the ethos of avant-garde.
Well, once again, I'd say that that's coming from a prepackaged word set. He was not avant-garde in and of himself. You know, it's debatable whether he originated anything he did, just as it's debatable that any commercial artist originated what they did, but he interpreted what was being done. It is very clear in the work that he did, like Ghost in the Underblows, where he's using typecase materials.
What does that mean, typecase materials?
Well, the metal that is used to separate words. I mean, the word leading, for example, comes from hot metal. They're little pieces of lead that separate lines from one another, and you can use a 1-point piece of lead or a 2-point piece of lead, and that's how you get your line spacing. But it came down to, you know, the technical terminology is leading.
Okay.
You know, if you want to make a thick rule around something, border, frame, you would use a piece of lead that had that was 2 points or 3 points thick, and that would stand above the printing area.
Right, okay.
It was an intaglio way of printing.
Yeah.
I always get the terminology confused as part of my manner of being confused, but the raised...
It's not bad. Confusion's not all bad.
The raised portion of what you see on a type chase, the printable material, is what would be used by many designers to create patterns or grid forms or squares or triangles or whatever it is you want.
It's like he used like everything around the letters as well as the letters themselves and plonk them down a kind of in a repeating forms.
Right. But Ghost in the Underblows was clearly an abstract design using those forms in a very deliberate manner. It wasn't Jackson Pollock splattering paint on a canvas.
You're going to have to excuse me in this interview for asking stupid questions, but I recently read that those were the best kind of questions.
Fine with me. I give you stupid answers.
I don't want that. No, thanks. Just moving along here. I want to quote you because you're so quotable. I love this book too. I think maybe we should talk about the book for a second. The book is called Born Modern, The Life and Design of Alvin Lustig by Stephen Heller and Elaine Lustig Cohen. It's just beautiful.
And it's designed by Tamar Cohen, Elaine's daughter, and the daughter of Elaine's second husband, Arthur Cohen, who was a bibliophile, an author, a Judaic scholar.
He's not the Arthur Cohen who set up Noonday and Meridian paperbacks, is he?
Exactly.
Isn't that great? Okay. This is you on Alvin. He demanded that readers decipher various visual signs and clues, played sly pictorial games with their perceptions. Importantly, he combined modern art with folk and primitive art, forging this hybrid into a contemporary graphic language.
Right. That's, I think, one of the assets of many modern designers, of many designers, period, whatever you want to call them, label them. They take from the world around them and infuse them into their works. So there are many different movements where variety of visual sources are used. I mean, we go back to the Expressionists, and some of their members, like Ernst Kirchner, used African art in his woodcuts.
Yeah, but so did Picasso. Picasso's the guy.
Picasso's the guy that opened that up, but if you look at, who is he again? Gauguin.
He actually went there, didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, not to Africa, but to
the South Seas.
Tahiti, yeah. Yeah. You figure he was the guy that...
Well, I don't figure he was the origin. I think
no.
The origin comes from many sources, and...
Yeah.
There are many artists who used what is considered primitive work. Primitive only because it hasn't been tutored. Primitive because it comes without any overlay of intellectual rationale, and it's applied, or what's the term now is colonized.
Right. Well, it's primitive, but we're not being pejorative here.
No. No.
Yeah, okay. Lustig seldom relied on literal solutions. His method was to read a manuscript to get the feel of the author's creative drive, quote unquote, and then restate it in his own graphic terms. This approach could easily be confused with art for art's sake or style for style's sake, since the cover designs were so far from providing any literal clue to the plot or contents.
Yeah, that was what I mentioned earlier. He avoided literalism. Literalism can kill a good piece of art. Literalism at its worst is social realism, socialist realism, national socialist realism. If you look at the New York Times today, or yesterday on it, the online version, there are photographs of the juvenilization of the Russian army, which is kind of reminiscent of Hitler Youth or the Boy Scouts for that matter. But the murals that are being put up around Moscow that celebrate youth and the Soviets or the Russian state is just pure heroic realism, which takes any humanity out of a picture and makes it a pure symbol. And as Paul Rand said, if you take that out, if you take the humanity or the expression out of something, you're left with pure content. And if you're left with pure content, that's not art. That's something else.
It's so interesting that Rand and Alvin Lustig both wanted to be considered serious artists, and yet there's this ulterior motive, and that is to sell and persuade.
Serious artists.
Doesn't that undermine everything?
Not at all. A serious artist is somebody who creates a vision, and that vision can be used for anything. Was Michelangelo a serious artist or a commercial artist? He was creating propaganda for the single organization that created the word propaganda. So, you know.
You're talking about the Catholic Church there?
Yeah, that church.
That one? Okay.
Pope Gregory created the propaganda of an order of Jesuits that were the first codified propagandists in the world. But both Rand and Lustig, Rand and Lustig both wanted to create good work.
Yes. Now,
if good work was considered by you and me to be art, then so be it. If good work was to be interfered with, if there was somebody who had the last word and said, I'd rather have blue than green for no particular reason other than taste, that was a sin. Putting in a decorative element for no particular reason was a sin. So, you know, art has many different fathers and mothers, reasons for being. And Lustig, he never really created paintings as such or sculptures as such. His furniture were the sculptures, and his rugs and his wall hangings were the paintings. But they were also used on the book covers and packages that he created and the stores that he designed. So that, you know, that distinction between pure art and commercial art, it's there, it exists. But I think in these people's eyes, these modernists' eyes, there were just different degrees of output. One of those degrees happened to be for selling and persuading, and the other was for reflection and interpretation. And sometimes they intersected. That would be terrific.
Yeah, I think the key to what you're saying, and the key to these two particularly, is that they were given a broad license to create. And if they have that, if no one can kind of fuck with their stuff, then I think what you're saying holds water. But
there are always rules.
If they didn't have that sort of final say, that final sign off, then it kind of undermines this idea of serious art.
Well, it undermines it in certain contexts. There's a letter that I think I quote in the book from Lachlan to Lustig from expressing Tennessee Williams' response. Yes. To one of his covers, one of his jackets. Right. And it was a collage, and there was the use of a feather for some reason. And Lachlan says Tennessee really loves the cover, but he didn't like the feather, so he took it off. You can use it in something else. And I think Alvin got $150 for the cover. He basically wasn't going to put up a fuss. You know, there are artists now who believe that if anybody touches anything of theirs, that a crime has been committed. And, you know, that's great. It's fine to have that feeling and then be considered difficult to work with. But it happens in all the arts, and it happens in the so-called fine arts. You know, it's usually if somebody commissions a painting and wants that painting or sculpture to represent a certain thing, if there's something wrong with it, because they've paid for it up front, they're going to feel they have a say in its outcome. But if they're buying something off the wall, they're certainly not going to tell the artist to change it.
Right. Incidentally, you quote Alvin as calling Tennessee Williams a pill.
Yeah, well, there are lots of brilliant people out there who are not just pills, they're assholes. You know, I remember when I was 18 or so and I was art directing a publication, I was naive to be kind about it. But there was some things that I was asked to change that I didn't want to change. And my editor went looking for a passage that he had read about some author. I think it was Ray Bradbury, who said, just because so-and-so is a genius, that doesn't mean he's wrong all the time.
Okay, final question here. What have you gotten out of studying these great graphic designers?
Well, that's a good question. And it's there are a number of answers to it, ranging from the egotistical to the self-serving, which may be
that's a good range.
The same. I've had the ability and the bragging rights to say I've studied them and I've written about them. And like a soldier's ribbon bars, I keep the books that I've done on my shelf as they would on their uniforms.
You need a wide shelf for those.
Well, you look at some of these generals, particularly in the North Korean army, and they're full of badges. They must be weighed down by them. But the other is that I've learned lessons about life and art that I wouldn't have learned on my own. I did not graduate college. I've just finished writing a memoir of 10 years of my life.
Is that where all these things that you've learned are stored?
Well, not really, because it's a formative 10 years. It's called Growing Up Underground. And it's about my life in the counterculture, which meant the first publications I ever worked on and learning to notice the tips of those icebergs that I've explored deep down much later than the years I'm talking about now. But I've learned a lot by researching lives of different designers and artists.
What's the most important thing you've learned?
I've learned that there's such a thing as genius. And going back to your first question about magic, I can only say that there's something magical. Some people might call it spiritual. Some people may call it genetics. But there's something that goes on where the genes and the brain and one's ability just come together. And they can create something that's unprecedented. You know, Steve Jobs did it with the Apple computer. Graham Bell did it with the telephone. Thomas Alva Edison did it with light, electricity, movies. You know, everybody worked off of somebody else's origination, but created something that we couldn't live without. I don't think that I've gotten to that point or will ever get to that point. But it's been a way of being close to those people And knowing that those people had their own flaws and foibles and faults, learning that perfection doesn't exist unless you really strive for it, learning that perfection isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all of life. One story about Alvin is that when he was blind, and Elaine tells this story, he would design his jackets, even though he couldn't see, he knew perfectly what colors were and how to describe them. And he could see his mind's eye. He didn't have to see the world around him, which he probably would have preferred to have done. But he had enough information in his brain where he could dictate what he wanted to design, where he could dictate not just verbal language, but visual language. And that's kind of amazing. I guess Beethoven was able to do it with music.
Well, yeah, he went deaf, though, didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, I think you're doing and have done something that's the opposite of being self-serving, as you might have suggested. You've done a great service to people like me who loves books and design. So thank you for all of your work, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me about Alvin Lustig today.
Well, thank you for asking me once again, the second day in a row.
I might have to ask you again when your memoir comes out.
Cool.
So thanks again, Steve. It's been a real privilege.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.